around the world. And that's the end of the interview with Holkout on 20 August 1979. This is now interviewing Professor Franz Kahn, on 20 August 1979 at the IAU. Can you first tell me what your educational background was, and then how you first came into contact with radio astronomy?
Well, I studied mathematics at Oxford, that was from 44 to 47. 1946, Sidney Chapman came to Oxford as Professor of Applied Mathematics, and I started doing research with him on solar-terrestrial relationships
in
1947. And then in 1949, I moved to Manchester as assistant lecturer in mathematics. Now, at the time, Blackett was professor of physics.
Right.
And he was quite interested in solar-terrestrial relationships. And also, of course, he pushed the radio astronomer. He encouraged Lovell to go ahead and build instruments. And he put me in touch with Lovell and Hanby Brown. Mm-hmm. So I visited them from time to time.
What are your memories of visiting that group?
Well, it was it started off being a sort of rather amateur type effort. I think at the time I got there, Hanbury had just finished building a fixed dish, the stringing wire
right,
and so on.
Right.
And he was beginning to identify radio objects like Andromeda Nebula, I think the Crab Nebula as well. And now, I think the interest, my sort of interest in particular problems in radio astronomy was first aroused by the Crab Nebula. And discussion then was, what was the energy source for the Crab Nebula? And we had a physicist with us, a man called Ramsey,
yes,
who was interested in geophysics largely. I mean, you may remember he's got...
Is this Norman Ramsey?
No. Bill. That was W.H. Ramsey. He was... how much of this can you put in the book? Because I suppose you can't.
Anything that is directly...
Actually, Ramsey was an interesting type, because right. he was one of the best physicists that we had. As you'll see if you look at his work on sort of nature of planetary cores and so on, he was writing about
mm-hmm.
And as far as the Crab Nebula is concerned, he was the first person to suggest that there might be decay of radioactive nuclides that provides the energy source.
I see.
It didn't actually work because the hot gas won't explain the spectrum of the Crab Nebula. That was the point of that first article you've got there about the Crab Nebula.
In 52.
A free emission, irrespective of what the spectrum is, it can't give you the intensity for the Crab Nebula. Well, unfortunately.
So these electrons were beta particles?
Whatever they are, whether they are fast electrons from decay or whether they're already thermalized, free emission will not give you the power.
Right.
That was the point of that. And that had largely to do with the kind of spectrum you get from. Just the collision between electron and proton. So it was a fairly simple argument. Ramsey, unfortunately, fell out because he had a drink problem, and so we won't find many papers from him after about the mid-50s. Now, what's the next thing? My next sort of real contact with radio astronomers was... there's one other thing. You'll find a speculation, a paper of mine on interstellar dust, that maybe charged dust grains might have something to do with it, but
was this for the general galactic background?
Just for before I knew anything about radio sources whatsoever. You see. Now, the next contact radio astronomy was really in Leiden. I went to Leiden for a year.
Well, hold on now. This charge to us, was that for the discrete sources?
Just for this, any sort of radio source, yeah.
Right, not for the galactic background.
I wasn't too clear about the distance.
And where did you publish that? I didn't catch that.
That was in a paper on the nature of interstellar dust and the reason why dust grains might grow elongated.
And in which journal?
That was Monthly Notes, yes.
Okay.
Then I went to Leiden for a year.
In what year was that?
53-54. Sorry, correction. It first arose at a meeting in Cambridge, Cosmical Gas Dynamics.
Yes.
July 1953. The things that we discussed there were, first of all, how does the interstellar gas keep warm? And my suggestion was one had to take into account the dynamical effects and that via cloudy structure. The other one is, what was the meaning of the temperature that you measure in interstellar
space? You mean heating by turbulence?
Heating by turbulence, that was one thing. The other thing was, what's the meaning of the temperature? What does the 100 degrees K mean?
Right.
And there you know, I made the point that what one's really measuring is the harmonic mean.
That's right. That's right.
That occurs there. Then there was another thing that
was. This was then adopted by the Dutch.
Well, that was that became
all their subsequent.
Possible, yes.
Yes. Right.
And another thing which connects with radio astronomy was actually came up in discussion we had at the Cosmical Gas Dynamics meeting on the solar wind. And there, I think at that meeting was the first time I don't remember anyone mentioned the collision-free shock. It was a question of why is there a sudden onset, it was long before anyone took any space measurements, why is the sudden onset of magnetic storms? And when, if you calculate plasma properties, mm-hmm. it should take weeks for this front to cross the Earth. And there we, so a number of us first discussed the possibility of plasma interactions giving rise to shock-like phenomena in gas flow.
And why do you say that this was connected with radio astronomy?
Well, this is obviously connected with radio astronomy, because almost anywhere you have a shock in a radio astronomical object, you have to have a collision-free shock.
So what you're saying is you carried over this kind of idea to radio sources.
Yes, and then I tried later, actually, in papers on counter-streaming to plasmas to see whether that could give rise also.
Right.
But that is not the right, obviously.
Well, I'm interested in what's right and wrong. I want to know what was going on.
And right. Now, in Holland, I guess we got in contact with the 21-second work. They were then just beginning to explore the galaxy with 21. It's been established that there is this 21 cent.
Right.
We're beginning to explore. And they had a big team of sort of human computers working on things and taking out lines and so on. Now, this is what you asked me about, this paper on the sort of removal of bandwidth from observational data. It struck me at the time that the method they were using was too accurate. But what you're doing with, when you're convolutes. I mean, when you're observing, you convolute the signal with something of finite bandwidth, and therefore you suppress the high frequency for your
right.
components. What you're trying to do is put them back. Well, what you do if you do it too well is you put back noise. I mean, this sounds so obvious now. It wasn't
obvious at the time. There was a lot of debate at that time.
And this is precisely what they were doing, because what they were finding in 21 centimeter reductions was that quite often, they when they produced the data, they came out with negative intensities, and then of course there aren't any negative intensities, so they snip them off, and therefore they were left with too much intensity on the positive side.
Right.
And
what was their actual method of
they used some method, I think it goes back to Eddington, but they describe it somewhere, and something, I forget exactly what it was.
So there was data published with this method?
Lot of the early maps are too sharp, mm-hmm. for that reason.
But had Bracewell come out with any of his stuff by that time, or was this just before?
I
think it was, yeah.
Anyway, my main work in light was concerned with ionization of H2 regions, and I suppose that has sort of vague connections with radio astronomy.
Well, certainly.
To do with the Ortspitzer mechanism and to put some gas dynamics into this rocket, because the rockets were deemed to be much more efficient than they really are.
This was not directly connected with the radio work going on.
Well, in a sense it was, because they were trying to explain what maintains the turbulence in interstellar
the
10 gas.
Kilometers a second.
So the idea was that if you could use the rocket effect to give a push to the gas clouds.
I see, that's right.
Then you're in business again, but it turns out that's too optimistic of you. And there's one other contribution that I made there inadvertently in line, because one day Ort decided that everybody ought to take a turn in making observations. And in the middle of winter, it was very hard to send out to the radio telescope and spend a couple of weeks there just sort of cranking handles and reading clocks and so on. And I didn't know what I was doing, and I just sort of sent back the charts and so on and said that everything had been done correctly. And then this was fed to this team of human computers in Leiden.
Right.
And Ort and Müller and van der Hals just written their first definitive paper, which is sort of stating categorically maximum temperature in the galaxy. The gas is 100 degrees Kelvin, full stop. Well, this caused a lot of consternation, and then I got messages from various people. See, the center of the disturbance was obviously Ort, but it sort of came by Schmidt and Mr. Hart. And they said, have I measured Sagittarius time correctly? Yes. was the snow on the telescope? No. wanted to have a meter set correctly. So I said yes. So in the end, they sent Westerhout out again. What was the trouble was that one of these readings had shown a maximum of 125 degrees.
Oh, I see.
And it was 1 degree off the plane in Taurus. And as a result of that, the galactic plane was tipped by 1 degree. And there's a footnote in that paper where it says,
I see,
recently 125 degrees has been measured.
And that was your measurement. That's interesting.
That's mine. Well, I mean, it could have been done by office boy. Nothing to do with me.
No.
Right. Now, let's see. Went back to England, and then we started a very interesting time in the physics department, because and this is loosely connected with radio astronomy, is Hanbury-Brown's interferometer.
Yes.
Which I think you ought to include.
Well, no, the intensity interferometer is a very interesting thing.
Right. That must be in there, because it starts off as a concept in radio astronomy.
Right.
Now, you probably know that he and Twist designed the intensity interferometer because they were worried about transmitting radio signals over long distances, and
right.
realized that he'd often have to have baselines.
Maintaining phase over such long distances.
Great Britain or something, yes.
Right.
Then he proved that this intensity interferometer worked. And
both theoretically and experimentally.
Proved it as an experiment.
Right,
it was a long time after, it was about 1955, I'm talking about 1955, long before he published his paper with Twist. Then he thought, well, if it works at long wavelengths, then it should work at short wavelengths, because the quantum theory is true at long wavelength as at short wavelengths. Just that nobody in his right mind would ever think about quantum theory while talking about it. And so he proposed to build this optical instrument. And now this came to the ears of the theoretical physicists, and they said, it says on page 8 of Dirac that you can't do observations of phase and intensity simultaneously. And they had endless discussions at lunchtime about, was this possible, wasn't it possible? And then in the end we realized that it was just a question of Bose-Einstein statistics versus ordinary statistics, and if you did it with something with fermions, then you'd get an anti-correlation where Hanbury-Brown gets a correlation. He was told.
There were several letters in Nature back and forth on this also, I remember.
Yeah. Purcell published a thing in Nature about it. Hanbury-Brown and Twist did the statistics from a wave point of view in Paper and Royal Society.
Right.
And
yes.
I did it with photons, just photon counting, and you can show that you get the same results, and you can also get a figure of the signal to noise ratio we expect, and so on. That's it up to after 1958.
Would you say it's correct that Purcell's paper in Nature sort of settled the argument, or?
Well, I just said, if you like, I mean, by sort of 1955, 56, people were starting to discuss how to do the statistics of these sort of
right,
but
this is later now, I think, these
and
papers.
Purcell was
57,
57
8,
or something.
Yeah.
You know, we'd settled it in our own minds before Purcell ever wrote. And,
I see.
It took me a while to get this thing published because it wasn't sort of deemed to be orthodox. But I thought it better be published also, so you'll find that.
Let me just ask you about the, at Leiden, what is your impression of the style of the group, the way the group operated?
Best group I've ever been.
In what sense? I mean,
it had a purpose. That's the first thing. That purpose was Oort's ideas, you know, about how galaxies should be explored. They sort of were the inspiration for everybody. Of course, I mean, there were grumbles. For instance, these human computers, they didn't like it too much.
Yeah.
And some of the others thought, you know, that they got the feeling that they felt occasionally being overridden. But I think when you have a person like Oort in charge of an institution,
yeah.
he has a right to override other things.
Yeah.
I mean, we're not talking about an ordinary person, we're talking about
a great
astronomer. That certainly was, that's my sort of archetype of a good institution. And my other archetype is the Institute in Princeton, so at the time, or soon after, Parity was discussed. And had
the Institute for Advanced Study,
yes,
you mean? Yes.
But among the physicists, there weren't enough astronomers to
right.
talk like that. There was the same sort of activity there, except it was not so highly articulated, but they sort of really worked together
mm-hmm.
in the same way as they did like. Now, of course, with Oort's getting older and retiring, that's been lost.
Yeah. But now, Going back to Manchester, did your contacts continue with Jodrell Bank?
Oh, yes. We,
throughout the 50s?
I used to go and see them. The physical, the reason why we had all these discussions at lunchtime was that the people at Jodrell are, the staff members are in general obliged to teach university courses, so they come in and see them
right.
at lunchtime, tea time, and so on. And also, they, you know, they made it a habit occasionally to come and discuss some theoretical problems, like this business about the signal to noise ratio and various experiments. So that kept us in touch fairly constantly.
Well, to raise another specific point, you wrote a couple of papers about Cygnus A and the possibility of a two-stream collision and instability and so forth. What was, of course, it was that with the intensity interferometer that was first shown to be a double source, and then you had the photograph showing a double nucleus sort of thing. But what were the thoughts about this, all the radio is coming from out here and yet the collision's going on down in here?
That was never clear in our mind.
That seems like it was also ignored in the papers.
Yes, exactly, yes. No, nobody was clear about that, and I don't think that in general until, you know, quite recently, five, 6 years ago, Martin Rees started talking about jets and so on, and people formulated these problems clearly in their minds.
Yeah.
It was just the question of where does the energy come from.
That was the first thing.
That was the first thought, yes. Yeah. And nobody had realized how much energy is actually necessary. I mean, you'd never get it out of it. If one had known then what one knows now, one would never have tried it with a collision of two galaxies.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously not energetic enough.
Why was that the prevailing theory? What do you think was the thing that really made that to be popular in this
case? I think, was it the Bardet?
Well, they proposed it, yes.
They said that they could see two objects. And, I think that's probably...
But, of course, it wasn't just for Cygnus A. I mean, there were several other sources that looked like they were doubles, but it became sort of an accepted thing for many years. I'm just wondering...
Well, maybe once Bard had seen something, everybody else saw it and everything else. I think they didn't like to question Bard's ability, as I'm saying.
Yeah, well, he dominated the field too.
But one more thing.
Yes.
And that is the twist in the galaxy.
The warp of the disk. Yes.
Now that arose during when I was in Princeton and Low Vulture and I shared an office.
Mm-hmm. What year now are you talking about?
I was in 58, 59, and we discussed. Well, he was interested in intergalactic matter, we discussed what would happen if you immersed the galaxy in intergalactic matter, and gradually came to this possible mechanical picture. Later on, about 5-6 years later, Vulture sort of renounced his support of this, and that was at the Nordwijk radio astronomy.
Right, in 66,
That the basis of that is that it will only work if the flow past the halo is subsonic. It's a typically symmetrical flow that you get when a smooth obstacle
mm-hmm.
flows smoothly through subsonic flow. And if it was supersonic, then you wouldn't get any of those friction. Now, at the time, we thought, by the time 1966 came, that friction would really be quite severe. But you raise turbulence and you get the friction. I'm beginning to change my mind back again about the friction. That may not be the case because just lately been working on sort of motion of hot jets past cool gas, and it's surprisingly difficult to get a lot of turbulent friction.
I see.
Between because nothing can happen at a speed which much exceeds the speed of sound in the cool gas. So if you've got a halo which is significantly which is such that that you can't respond quickly enough, then you might indeed get the halo as a smooth obstacle in the way.
So I see.
I think there's possibly still a little truth that such interactions.
This was a paper published in 59. The observational data on the warp had been already established.
Oh yes, that was there at the sort of 1 degree level.
Right. Let me ask, as you look back over the 50s mm-hmm. and early 60s, in particular with the Jodrell Bank group that you were closest to, what do you see as their main contributions to astronomy as a whole?
Well, I think the work that they did with the simple instruments, in fact.
With which?
With the simple instruments that they built. Hanbury Brown identifying the Andromeda and the nebula. I think the sort of basic work they did with interferometers, kind of work that Henry Palmer sort of pioneered.
The sub-arc-second components.
Up to what date do you want to go?
Well, early 60s, 62, 3, 4, 5 at the most.
Well, 65. You might just include the detection of radio, the cosmic ray showers by radio. That was about that time.
That's true. That was.
Although that turned out a little bit disappointing because it wasn't. You know, they thought maybe they'd be able to do these observations from the ground. But it was very difficult to calibrate cosmic ray showers.
Right.
So that had been wrong. That's later.
Well, let me generalize the question to radio astronomy as a whole. What do you think? How has it changed our picture of this universe around us? Once again, up to 60 or 65.
Well, I think from by 65. No one was aware of quasars, of course.
Yes.
You realise that the scale of phenomena with which you're familiar looking at stars, optical objects were known then, and they were far transcended by things that went on in objects like quasars. I suppose that quasars would have been discovered without radio astronomy. It would have taken
a bit longer.
Longer, yes.
Yeah.
So one might have eventually come to the same conclusions. But you know, I've long thought, and I certainly think so now, that it probably isn't reasonable to separate out one bit of astronomy from another. I mean, that you have to look at what the whole spectrum tells you,
right?
And because that's what makes you think about connections between things. So I just say radio astronomy is obviously an essential part of astronomy, just like optical astronomy is. All the other wavelength ranges are. And it's very hard to pin anything down to a particular point. If one of the ranges of wavelengths was missing, you'll still be able to do your work, but it would take you longer.
Mm-hmm.
None of them is absolutely essential. And just like you'd be able to get along even if you only had one leg, but you'd be walking much more slowly.
You don't see any particular unique role for the radio being the first to break this optical bind. I mean, there had been some infrared, but really pretty minimal.
Yeah.
The first to really...
It helped us get at the high-energy phenomena a bit more quickly. I suppose we'd have got to them other ways as well.
Yes. And the Seyfertz, of course, had been known before.
I mean, you know, that once you'd started thinking about the Crab Nebula, for instance, you'd have known there were relativistic electrons.
You would have found the optical pulsar there eventually.
In fact, all these things would have happened, but it would have just taken longer.
Yes. Interesting points. Any other comments you'd like to make about this era of radio astronomy?
Well, it's always a lot more to be said, but I didn't have time.
Okay, thank you very much. That is the interview with Kahn at the IAU in Montreal on 21 August 1979.